We're in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. The title of the message is The Tone and Manner of Gospel Ministry. We've already looked at our point number one. I'm going to read the whole passage, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, knowing that we've already looked at the first eight verses, and we'll pick it up in verse 9. Paul is going to be talking about the points that we have. Are point number one, our gospel witness. And point number two, our gospel labor. Listen for that. We've talked quite a bit of the content of the first part, but we'll be jumping into the second part here momentarily. In chapter 1, verse 1, it says, chapter 2, verse 1. Paul speaking to the church in Thessalonica, and he says, "For yourselves, brethren, know our entrance in unto you, that it was not in vain. But even after that we had suffered before, and were shamefully entreated, as you know, at Philippi, we were bold in our God to speak unto you the gospel of God with much contention. For our exhortation was not of deceit, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile. But as we were allowed of God to be put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, which trieth our hearts. For neither at any time use we flattering words, as ye know, nor a cloak of covetousness, God is witness, nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet of others, when we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ, but we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because you were dear unto us. You remember, brethren, our labor and travail, for laboring night and day, because we would not be chargeable unto any of you, we preached unto you the gospel of God. Ye are witnesses, and God also, how holily and justly and unblameably we behaved ourselves among you that believe. As ye know, how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you, as a father doth his children, that you would walk worthy of God, who hath called you unto his kingdom and glory." So I hope you remember and picked up the two great illustrations here, this in verse number, what verse is it? The gentle among you, verse number 7, this nurse cherishing her children. Of course, that's a mother, that's a nursing mother. And we talked about this, the gentility of the gospel ministry. And throughout these verses, verse number 2 and 3 and 4, there are several positive and negative statements that Paul gives, that he's trying to describe the tone and manner of his ministry. You might say, what did it feel like to be around Paul? What was he like? Now, we talk doctrine so much, sometimes we forget about how this is all supposed to fit together. How does it flow? Well, it flows like a mother and flows like a father. We call ourselves a church family. I'm passionate about this. You'll hear me say it a lot. This is not a business, folks. We don't have a customer service desk and where you can bring returns and we don't have a menu. You say, "Give me a number one biggie size with a Coke." You know, we don't do that here. This church is a family. And see, this is one of the subversive ways that the devil attacks churches. He at first attacks families. So in our culture, probably for the first time in America in a long time, people don't even know what a right family looks like. So how are you supposed to know what a church looks like? See how all this works? So we have to bring ourselves back to the Scripture, to bring ourselves back to the Bible and say, okay, what's it supposed to look like? No matter what our families look like. Everybody's family's different. You shouldn't be ashamed of that, or you shouldn't be proud of that. But what we have to do is catch the vision that Scripture is giving to us for what our personal life ought to be, for what our family life ought to be, and what our church ought to be. We're starting in verse 9 because here he's going to start talking about, and the point is, your gospel labor. Look in verse 9. He says, "You remember, brethren, our labor and travail." He begins to discuss his labor, and while we might immediately think he's speaking of his labor in the ministry, which is reasonable, look back at verse 3 of chapter 1. It's probably right on the same page there. Remember, he talked about their work of faith and labor of love and patience of hope, right? So you think he's talking about the labor of the ministry, which is really reasonable. But he's actually specifically speaking of his physical labors. You may not know, but you may need to remember, Paul was a bivocational minister. That means he had a regular job. And I got to tell you, most of the, if you look at the whole world and look at all the Christian pastors in the whole world, most of them are bivocational. It's a privilege to have a salary and to be focused on vocational ministry. It really is a privilege. But Paul was probably like most pastors or most missionaries in his day. And you don't have to turn there, but I'm going to read to you quickly from Acts chapter 18 because you literally see it. Paul comes to Corinth and he found a certain Jewish couple named Aquila and Priscilla. They had come from Pontus and had lately come from Italy. And it says here in verse 3, because he was of the same craft, Paul abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation, they were tent makers. And you might have heard that people say a bivocational ministry, I've got a tent making ministry. That's what they're talking about in our day. But in Paul's day, he was literally making tents because that's how he supported himself. This is going to be important for us as we look at this passage. The principle is Paul was a diligent worker and his work made possible his ability to preach the gospel. But look just a little bit farther in the verse 9. We find another clue of what he's thinking about. He goes, "We would not be chargeable unto any of you." This is what Paul is beginning to talk about here. It was important to Paul that he didn't cause the church to incur expenses on his account. And I want to show you this because this is not the only time he said it. And forgive me for jumping around. I want to show you a couple different passages. You don't have to turn there. I will provide the words. But I'm going to be reading in 2 Thessalonians, 2 Corinthians, and 1 Corinthians. But what I want you to listen for is he's literally saying the same thing. In 2 Thessalonians 3:7, he says, "For yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we behaved ourselves not disorderly." And in 2 Thessalonians 3:7, the word disorderly literally means lazy. It's like, we weren't lazy. You ever have a house guest who comes in and they like sit on the, well, it is a little unusual, but they sit on the couch and eat potato chips and you're like, make yourself at home. You know, he was like, we weren't like that kind of house guest for you guys. He says, "Neither did we eat any man's bread for naught, but we wrought with labor and travail night and day that we might not be chargeable to any." There's that word again. We didn't cause any expense on you guys' part, not because we have not power, he says. This is the privilege to accept wages, but to make ourselves an example to you to follow us. So here's another clue of what Paul is saying. We were supporting ourselves, not because... Now, you might say, well, is it wrong to give a missionary like a love gift or pay a pen? No, he's literally saying in this passage, all those things are okay. We were doing this intentionally because we were setting an example for you. Still, Paul is always setting an example, but this particular one is of conscientious hard work in the context of ministry. It should be unfathomable of us to think that anyone would question Paul's ministry. But in the first century, they did. They questioned his apostleship and everything. And it's really clearly seen in 2 Corinthians. I'm reading from chapter 11, verse 5. He says, "I was not a whit behind the very chiefest of apostles." You know, think of Peter and James and John and such. "But though I be rude in speech, yet not in knowledge..." Paul is not saying he was rude, but Paul is describing himself as being pretty simplistic in his presentation. He goes, "I might be pretty simple in the way I talk, but not in knowledge. But we have been thoroughly manifest this before you. He said, you have seen our ministry for yourself, and you know that we're working hard. And he says, when I was present with you and wanted, I was chargeable to no man, for that which was lacking in me, the brethren which came from Macedonia supplied, and in all things I have kept myself from being burdensome unto you, and so I will keep myself. I pulled my weight. You guys didn't have to make up for the difference. His example was to work hard and to minister to them, listen to me, without expense. In 1 Corinthians 9, he says, what is my reward then? Verily, that when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel. There's that word power again. This issue of the gospel being available without charge is actually an important part of the ministry. Did we charge you to come in the door today? Try that at Disney. They practically charge you. Want some water? Oh, here's some water. Oh, I don't want to pay for it. Well, there's an old broken water machine over there. You can fill your... I had to go searching to fill up my water bottle at Disney, a couple weeks ago or whatever. And, you know, everybody wants to charge. Am I wrong? Everybody wants to charge you, literally, for everything. Not in the church. I'm not asking for your money. We took up an offering, but I didn't ask any of our visitors. If you're visiting here, if you've had a blessing, please leave some money on your way out. We don't talk like that here. We talked about this last time. I want you to carry something out, not carry something in. Although, in this case, what Paul is talking about does seem to involve money. It actually involves the issue of personal motive. Why is Paul doing this? Paul is establishing a purity of motive on the part of the person who is ministering. Peter says a very similar thing. He instructs pastors to be fully willing to be partakers of the ministry without mixed motives. In 1 Peter chapter 5, he says, feed the flock of God. This is what a pastor does. Feed the flock of God. You're being fed right now. You're at a buffet right now. Do you realize that? And sometimes, you know, listen, buffets are all a little bit different. Sometimes the buffets got a lot to choose from. Sometimes buffets don't have a little bit to choose from. But you only ever get from a buffet, listen to me, what you take off and put on your own plate. Hello? So, you know, it's feed the flock of God is what Peter's saying. And then he says... He's talking to pastors, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. And you might say, well, Pastor Farley, you're doing this because you get paid. I got news for you. I was doing this a lot longer not being paid than being paid. In fact, the first time I ever got paid to preach, here's the truth. Pastor Stewart, founding pastor of this church, he asked me to preach the morning message down at the chapel. It's now Chapel Baptist Church, a church we planted in down by Four Corners. He said, preach the morning service. He was on vacation, or I don't know what was going on. So I went down there and preached, and the church wrote me a check and gave it to me. I didn't know what to do with it. I've been teaching Sunday school since literally like the week I got saved. They put me in charge of a Sunday school class. I thought, you guys know what you're doing? But the pastor was crazy like a fox because he handed me the Sunday school material and goes, just whatever this says, that's what you teach. I'm like, okay. Well, it worked for me because I was the primary beneficiary of that. When you teach, you learn. And Peter's saying, you're not doing this. Filthy lucre is a fancy way of saying money. And Paul here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is not saying that pastors shouldn't be paid. He actually makes a case for that in 1 Timothy 5. But he mentions this power. It means that he does have the right to receive wages of the gospel. He's just not claiming that right. He's making a point. This simply highlights Paul's priority to eliminate charges of selfish motives. He doesn't want anyone to say, yeah, you're doing this for this reason or that reason. He's saying, no, I'm doing it because I love you, and I love the Word of God, and I love God, and all those things come together in the ministry of the Word, or counseling, or just being a friend in Christ. This is not just for pastors, folks. I'm not here preaching to myself. This is for all of us. So Paul's diligent hard work and purity of motives is the focus here in our text. And in a moment we'll see that this motive aligns with the second major illustration, this illustration of being a father, right? And this all aligns. But just for a moment, I want you to just think about what all this means up to this point, okay? As a believer, does it mean anything to you to know that you're fellow believers care about you personally? Just think about that. That's what this means. Why are we here? Why are you here? Why am I here? We all have this existential moment. You know, why are we all here? But seriously, why are you here? Why are you ministering here? Why did you come to church? Jesus said it this way. I'm reading out of Matthew chapter 20. He says, "You know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them." Did you know that all our politicians, do you know they get paid? They all say, "Oh, I love this country. We're gonna do all this kind of great stuff." Oh yeah, well you're getting a check at the same time. And all those people on TV, what do you think? Well, we have our panel of talking heads. What do you all think? Do you know they all get paid to do that? And we just think they're doing it out of goodwill. And I'm not trying to pick on them. Well, maybe I am a little bit. But he's talking about these princes of the Gentiles. And the attitude among some is, hey, you don't pay me, I don't show up. That's the way it is. You don't pay me, I'm afraid I'm just going to show up. You're not going to get rid of me that way. But Jesus says, it shall not be so among you. Not like that. Don't be like them, Jesus is saying. He goes, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. And to give his life a ransom for many. Now, I'm preaching to the choir because this church understands this principle. This church is full of servants. I'm so proud to be a member of this church. Because you understand what Paul is saying here. You're in it for the ministry's sake, for the love's sake. This is the gospel principle of servant leadership, and it is every bit part of the tone and manner of ministry. Everyone who desires to minister must lead with humility and be ready to serve others in a selfless manner. That's what it's supposed to be about. So we're talking about hard work and other oriented motives. But look at verse 10. Our gospel labor also should be characterized by Christian virtue. He started this list of virtues back in the last section. But he sort of makes his commentary, then he picks it back up. And he does this for a reason. List of virtues like this can be considered similar to what Paul provides in 1 Timothy chapter 3. He defines the blameless character of the pastor and the deacon offices in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 13. It's a great read, but it's like a list of virtues. Paul likes to list virtues, but he always has a reason for doing it. They're usually always in a particular order. This blamelessness, look at right in the middle of verse 10, he talks about unblameably we behaved ourselves. This blamelessness is defined by the very list of virtues that he gives. And he tells them that they have been witness of the reality of this. Actually, Paul will invoke the testimony of two witnesses, the church and God. Look at it. Start of verse 10. Ye are witnesses and God also. Those are two witnesses. That's intentional by Paul. This may be simply a rhetorical way to highlight and affirm their forthright behavior. God is witness, right? But you think about that. You say, why would you call on a witness who can't really talk? It's like it gives ground for the skeptic in a way. But in the ancient Near East, it was not unusual to call upon the witness of deity. This was a pretty common thing in Hellenistic culture. But also in the Bible, don't turn there, but I'm thinking of Deuteronomy chapter 4. God calls to bear the witness of heaven and earth. And he's talking to Israel, and he says, if you guys don't follow this law, I call upon heaven and earth to be witnesses against you, and we'll remove you out of the land. So this is where the witness makes a difference. Not in our day-to-day now, but at the judgment seat of Christ. He already said earlier in the passage, you back all the way up to the beginning of chapter 2, he says that God, we do all these things in the presence of God. Did you know that we are in his presence right now? Amen. And really all through the week. For the sinner, I guess, you could simply say that to know God is watching you is sort of like, oh, that's creepy, I don't want to know that, you know. But I'm sorry, for the servant of God, I find that to be not only a consolation, it's a privilege. I love the fact that God is watching me. And half the time I have to say, I'm sorry, Lord, did you see that? Yes, Tom. Okay, I'll go apologize or whatever. He says, you are witnesses and God only, how holily and justly and unblameably we behaved ourselves among you that believe. This holiness, holily, actually is not the actual name or word for holiness in the Greek. This means piety. This means in righteousness. So it's a little different word. But here he's talking about holily and justly. So he's talking about righteousness and fairness. Now think with me. Just glance over to chapter 2, verse 1. He talked about their entrance in unto them. Now, we didn't take time to do it, but I keep referencing this. When you read through the book of Acts in chapter 17, maybe the last time or the time before we looked at it, in chapter 17, it actually goes through the account of him being in Thessalonica. And I want you to read this to you. Just two verses, Acts 17, 6 and 7. They've called together the city council and they're making accusation against Paul and Jason and Silas and all them because they pulled Jason out of his house. And he says, these that have turned the world upside down are come hither also, whom Jason hath received, and these all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar. So they're making accusation against Paul and his ministry team there. This is in contrast to what Paul is saying, of course. They're being blamed of insurrection and chaos. And Paul is saying, no, you saw how we behaved. We were righteous and we were just and we were unblameable. You saw how we were. Paired together, Paul's saying that they actually dwelt with them in an honest and ethical manner, which is to say that they were, verse 10, blameless, not giving rise to accusation, things being done rightly. This word blameless is used in a whole host of places. I'm reading from Philippians 2. He says, do all things without murmurings and disputings. I love murmuring. It's onomatopoeia. Murmur, 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 murmur. That's how it is. Murmur. People like to talk, don't they? And gossip always thinks. Everyone thinks gossip is so true because it seems like it's an outside source. Oh, you can trust the outside sources. Murmur, murmur, murmur. He says, do all things without that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God. So blamelessness becomes a euphemism for a whole host of virtues that all come together and define our character as Christians. There were some additional ways. I'm looking at verse 11. that Paul and his team engaged with a church at Thessalonica that can be instructive to us. Look, they were exhorting. To exhort means to encourage. It's like the football coach. Come on, guys! We're in the second half of the game! You gotta push! You guys go, whoa, come on! And then the football team comes out onto the field, and what are they? They're all fired up for the second half, right? And we encourage one another? In your sales meeting at work, come on, guys, let's bring our sales average up. Whatever. We're used to this as a society. We do it in the church, too. He says there's this comforting also. The word means to console. It could be actual Christian counseling, or maybe just be sitting beside someone, putting your arm around them and say, hey, how you doing? You okay? You know, people a lot of times are afraid to tell me anything. But I know a lot of you can pull a person aside and say, talk to me, how are you doing? That's a ministry. Encouraging, exhorting, comforting, consoling. And then he talks about this in verse 11, this urging. You exhort and comfort, and this word is charged. This is a really a complex, the word charged here is kind of complex. I think we know what a charge is. It's to say, you know, you got to do this. But the action feels like pleading and imploring, urging. The word literally means to bear testimony. So Paul and his team worked with the church, encouraging them in their walk, consoling them in their trials, and convincing them to endure. Does that sound good to you? Can we agree that in many places in our culture, we don't get this kind of positive and good treatment? Maybe in a place of work, at a public school, yeah, even at stores and restaurants, often people treat you poorly and roughly. You're just another customer. You're going to tip me good or not? Hey, that guy's a good tipper. Treat him good. That lady is a bad tipper. Don't treat her good. See, sometimes you feel like you're cattle. Often people who treat others badly are only focused on their immediate circumstance or the bottom line. They're not concerned with the long-term personal well-being of others. God help us in the church if we ever adopt such sinful attitudes. The church should be the one place where we always know we're going to be treated well and good. The church ought to be the one place of our whole week where we'll receive encouragement and consolation that we need. The church ought to be the one group of people that will cheer us on, urging us to endure. Maybe with Paul it sounded something like this. Isaiah 35 says, strengthen ye the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. He will come and save you. Folks, you thought the gospel was just the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. That's glorious enough. But I just read to you from Isaiah 35, 4, and He said, I will come and save you. His eyes are upon you. Our God is a saving God. He was from the very beginning. This is the tone and manner of ministry that Paul established at Thessalonica. And it must always be, and I think it is here. Because I think everyone here understands these things. What a privilege it is to be a member of this church. It must always be the tone and manner of our church, but also our homes, and also our own personal manner must reflect these same other honoring virtues. Now, seamlessly, look at verse 11. This leads us to the second major metaphor and illustration in the passage. He says, we exhorted and comforted in charge of you as a father doth his children. Isn't that beautiful? It's just like bookendings in this passage. These two illustrations just dominate this section. The metaphor of motherly care was back in verse 7, and now we see this loving father. A father teaching and directing his own children. That's the only thing you can assume based on what Paul is already saying here. I just think a father knows best. Remember Father Knows Best? It was like an actual I know they weren't an actual family, but he was like such a good guy, you know? Robert somebody or whatever. It was like he explained things, and Bud was always doing something crazy, you know? Teaching, directing, and look at the end of the verse, that you would walk worthy of God, this father, so to speak. And he's not just talking about a male. He's not talking about a father per se. He's talking about this type of influence. An influence that has the objective of saying, I want everyone around me to be Christ-like and to walk worthy of God. And I want to do that too. One writer said this. He said, there are occasions when a father has the responsibility to reprove his child, but the correction should be coupled with kindness. In all cases, the father should be an example to his children. The Hellenistic attitude of Paul's day would have included the teaching of Aristotle and Philo, who said, a father's first care is for his children's welfare. This is old teaching, folks. Sounds new in our culture, doesn't it? The father's first care is for his children's welfare, not what's on TV tonight. And Philo said that a father's responsibility was not simply to give them knowledge of certain subjects, but to choose virtues and avoid vices and the activities to which they lead. Folks, if we just do these really old, take this really old advice, it could change the whole nature of our culture in America. All this helps us to understand the tone and manner of the ministry of Paul. At the same time, an example is here for each one of us, whether a lay person, whether a pastor. The church ought to be a special place where each of us receives the loving instruction that we all need to conduct our lives. To walk worthy of God. That's why we're here. When I asked before, why are you here? That's the reason, as a believer, that's why we gather together. You realize this is not actually where you're a Christian in church? I say this many times. Church is like a staff meeting at work. You don't make widgets, okay? Listen, at your place of work, you don't make widgets at the staff meeting. You eat the biscuits and the bagels that they served, you drink the coffee, you listen to the sales percentages, and you talk about work. But no actual work gets done, right? It was kind of like what we do here. We talk about the Lord. Well, it is different in that I do believe there is value in worshiping God together as a church. There is value in our fellowship of us being in each other's presence. So, point of fact, we do achieve something here, but it's all has to do with this picture, this objective that we have in our minds and our hearts. Let's face it, you know, not everyone has a good example in their lives to follow. Please consider also that it's not unusual at all that a believer would come into the church not having been brought up in a Christian home, and not ever having a biblical Christian example. So for that person, the church can be the only place where they can hope to observe mature believers. Do you see how important this is? See, this is a good reason for us to be personally present in the church services. I know. I understand the feeling. The feeling is, well, no, they don't need me. No one will miss me if I'm not there. Well, let me answer both those questions. Yes, we need you. And no, we will miss you if you're not here. Even if you're not putting hand to plow at teaching a Sunday school class or being in the nursery, it doesn't mean that your presence is useless. Your presence here is valuable because you're valuable. A father, for example, who abandons his home cannot lead his family. He can't set an example if he's not there. In the same way, we all must be in each other's presence to have a good and holy influence in each other's lives. You do matter. That's the only way all this can work. Listen to what it says in Proverbs 27. It says, "Ointment and perfume rejoice the heart. So doth the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. Thine own friend and thy father's friend forsake not. For better is a neighbor that is near than a brother that's far off." Isn't that great? It's like, just come sit next to me. And of course, you probably, as I always do, I think of Proverbs 27:17, "Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend." We can have a good influence for each other, because when you walk out of this place, guess what? All the bad influences begin, because the 24/7, 365 sermon begins the minute you turn on your radio or turn on your TV or look at the billboards or walk out of this place. Their sermon never stops. That's why we need each other. All this happens in the church when we're in each other's presence. Paul provides the illustration of a father here in verse 11. However, all believers need, and eventually you will provide, whether you like it or not, the teaching and the advice and the example that a mature Christian can personally demonstrate as we fellowship together as a church. You bring that in, and we all benefit from you. That's why we are called a church family. We're called... get used to it. You know, you hear the term BFF. You've heard that before, right? BFF. Well, I want to start saying CFF. The Church Forever Family. Because you know what? If you're a believer, we're just stuck with each other for all eternity. But all my grumpiness gets cut off. So you only get the best part of me, and I get the best part of you. But today we've talked about diligent hard work, walking in biblical virtues. Are you doing all that you can for the gospel? We've talked about purity of motive and why we do what we do. Why are you here today? We even mentioned murmurings, disputings, gossip, and accusations. They were picking on Paul, and Paul had to defend himself. God help us if we're making Christians have to defend themselves. How do you treat others? Are you encouraging, consoling? Are you and I walking worthy of God? There's something here for all of us. At this time of the invitation, I'm going to ask George and Rosie to come. I think there's something for each one of us to ponder. And rather than ask you, hey, come to the altar and make a decision, maybe there's no decision to make. Maybe this morning you don't need to make a decision. Maybe this morning you just need to pray. Well, I'm going to be up here. Pastor Lamb and others will be up here. And if you just need someone to pray with, you know, we'll just spend a moment praying with you. You take advantage of this moment.